Welcome to Jazz Rhythm and a program reassessing bandleader and clarinetist Artie Shaw.
How begin the behemoth through the ceiling? After 14 years, I was an instant celebrity. It's all it took, you know, one big record in those days, and you were on the way.
In this hour, we'll be hearing from Artie Shaw about his discomfort with celebrity and success, his band tour of the Pacific during World War II, about being investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and his eight marriages, including the viewpoints of at least two of his ex-wives, like this assessment from Evelyn Keyes.
I'm very glad to have known Artie Shaw. It's one of the better things that happened to me.
We'll also hear about Artie Shaw's struggle to find peace with himself, become a writer, and come to terms with life in America. Here's Shaw's description of his deep fondness for music, as read by Peter Coyote.
So you're trying to play a horn, and here's this clumsy series of keys on a piece of wood, and you're trying to manipulate them with the reed and the throat muscles and what they call an embouchure. You're trying to make a sound that no one ever got before, or a combination of sounds, creating an emotion, finally. It's like asking a poet, how do you get this combination? How did you get these words? Well, you do that in music. You're trying to take notes and make them come out in a way that moves you. If it moves you, it's going to move others. If you know it's right and you feel, this is something I meant. That happens. But very rarely does it happen, and you remember it for the rest of your life. What can I say? It's the most exuberant experience you can have. It beats sex, beats great food, beats anything.
W.C. Handy's Chantez La Ba, Sing 'em Low, recorded by Artie Shaw and his orchestra in 1940. Hi, I'm Dave Radlauer. Welcome to the award-winning Jazz Rhythm, a weekly exploration of the culture, lore, and personalities of early jazz. This is Artie Shaw Redux, reassessing and focusing on Artie Shaw's life, including his years after leaving music, as a writer, dairy farmer, book collector, and firearms enthusiast, among other things, his self-imposed political exile in Spain during the 50s, his hobbies, avocations, and interests. As we move into Shaw's story, we'll be hearing some live radio broadcasts from 1938 and 39. And at that time, Shaw had felt that the band had become just a little bit stale, and he brought in some fresh blood that he was really excited about, saxophonist Georgie Auld and drummer Buddy Rich. Listen for the energy in the band and the cohesive sound from the saxophone section that was a signature of Artie Shaw's best orchestras. On Carioca, Time Out, and
here's Artie Shaw's unique arrangement of his own original novelty, Hold Your Hat.
Opened the Palomar. It was a record night. There were 9,000 people. You could literally have walked across the ballroom without touching the floor. It was an incredible crowd. And halfway through the night, I collapsed. Just disappeared. I was out for 5 days. I came back to consciousness 5 days later. I had a thing called a granulocytosis, which is a form of leukemia. And so I got sicker and sicker and sicker, and finally they saved my life. I think at that time my obit was printed. When I came to, by the way, after the 5 days, I happened to open my eyes, and I looked up, and there was a face looking at me, and I looked, it was Judy Garland, who was one of my closest friends. She was like a little sister to me. She was about 16 at the time. And, how are you, she said. And I said, oh, fine, Judy. I could hardly talk. I was out. I was dead.
Thank you.
Shine On, Harvest Moon from a radio broadcast of 1938. This is Artie Shaw Redux on Jazz Rhythm, jumping swing, classic blues, and hot jazz, old and new. I'm Dave Redlauer. Thanks for joining me. Shaw recovered fully from his bout with leukemia and, typically, formed a new and equally successful band. The huge successes of 1938 and 40 sucked Shaw into a maelstrom of celebrity that would test the strongest personality. At the peak of his success, his reported weekly income was $30,000 a week. It surely must have been overwhelming for Shaw, who was an intelligent, erudite, and well-read person, and certainly stressful coping with a punishing schedule of appearances, performances, travel, recording, and broadcasting. Singer Helen Forrest.
The public adored him, male and female. As when he played, people went crazy. They screamed and they yelled.
I remember I wanted to go out one time, and the cops standing at the door, he said, "You can't go out of here. You'll be killed. You'll be mobbed." He opened the door and let me peek out. There must have been 5,000, 8,000 kids milling around the street.
Artie Shaw swings in the groove with an original composition, Time Out.
I had a brand new car. They had scrawled their names all over the canvas top. Some of them had carved their names with keys into the hood, into the painting. The paint of the car, their names, their initials, or their phone numbers. People stopped thinking. You're no longer a human being. You are an object to be celebrated. And right after a bunch of kids had jumped down onto the stage in the Strand Theater where we were playing, one kid jumped from the box, broke his leg. Meanwhile, I retreated to the bandstand, started playing. Some kids started jitterbugging on the stage. One of them swinging his girl around. Her heels hit the end of my horn. I thought it was going to knock my teeth out. Right after that show, somebody came backstage to interview me and said, "What do you think of jitterbugs?" I said, "They're a pack of morons." Well, that's all it needed. Jitterbugs are morons. Headline in that particular paper. And all of a sudden, people, placards marching up and down, Artie Shaw in fear. It's madness. Total insanity.
Again, Artie Shaw's words, the voice, Peter Coyote.
Success is a very big problem, bigger than failure. You can deal with failure, but success is an opiate, and you get very confused. Things happen that you have no preparation for. Money comes in, and people throw themselves at you, and you don't know what you're into. It becomes nuts. I couldn't handle it. I didn't know what to do with it. It was heady, a very heady dose. It's like getting drunk or getting high, a rush. A lot of people love it. Sinatra wouldn't live without it. A lot of people who have it have nothing but that in mind. In my case, it got in the way. I still wanted to play music, and the audience was saying, "Play what you're playing. Play the same thing over and over and over. We like that." For example, Begin the Beguine, which became an albatross around my neck. I loved it originally. I made a good record of it. But the audiences didn't understand. I was through with that. Hey, let's get on. And they never could get it through their heads that what they liked was something I was doing on my way to getting better.
Thank you. Time Out, a live broadcast of Artie Shaw's band. And again, at that time, he was showcasing such remarkable talents as drummer Buddy Rich and tenor saxist Tony Pastor and Georgie Auld. I'm Dave Redlauer. This is Jazz Rhythm. Artie Shaw was blessed with movie star good looks. In fact, I think he looked a little like the late TV and movie actor Danny Thomas. He had a firm jaw, a good head of jet black hair. He was tall and slim. And Artie Shaw was stylish, much more so than some of the other white big band leaders who, at least by today's standards, appear rather dowdy with their receding hairlines and bookish, wire-rimmed glasses. But the business of making movies proved even less gratifying to Artie Shaw than the falderall of the music business.
It was inevitable that the band would be hired to make a movie in which I would play myself in a fictional situation. That's what Dancing Coed was about. About halfway into it, I realized that was not a medium for me at all. I couldn't act. I was not supposed to be an actor. I wasn't there to be an actor. I was there for whatever commercial value my name could add to the movie. And at one point, they gave me some lines to read that I think had to do with something like Hepcats and alligators were now going to... Well, that was downbeat talk. That wasn't real talk. I didn't talk that way. So when I came to do the scene, being, again, unaware of the fact that the director is the dictator, he's law, I said, ladies and gentlemen, our next number will be, or we're now going to... And he stopped. He said, wait a minute, is that in the script? I said, what? He said, ladies and gentlemen, we didn't have that. We got Hepcats now. I said, I don't talk that way. Well, he said, what do you mean you don't talk that way? That's what the script says you're supposed to do. I said, no, the script says I'm Artie Shaw. I know more about how Artie Shaw does than your script does. So he said, you're in a movie here. I said, look, I'm in a movie playing Artie Shaw. You want to change my name to Joe Samuels? I'll stand on my head if that's what Joe Samuels is supposed to do. My name is Artie Shaw in this movie, and I'm going to talk like I do. Well, cut the line. After that, I hardly spoke three words in the movie. People think how marvelous it would be to be a celebrity. How marvelous it would be to have people look at you and applaud you. At a certain point, it becomes a bloody bore. If you want to get level off and be a human being for a while, there's nobody around with whom you can do it. One of the things I do after work, rather than going out, quote, partying or drinking, I used to go home and read. And I carried books around. I had a book bag I'd carry around with me, and I was always reading. The reading and the being interested in other things was really part of my training, my apprenticeship as a writer. So here I lived a kind of split life. Part of me going into it to be a writer, and the other part of it had to do with playing jazz, which had nothing to do with intellectualism, mostly. The press had a lot of fun with it because apparently they thought of band leaders as gum-chewing idiots. And I wasn't that type of guy. I didn't fit the mold. I started out to do this to make $25,000 to be a writer. Look at this insanity. I made $2.5 million. I made 25. I don't know how much money I made. By that time, I thought, if it ever gets that bad, I can't stand it anymore. I'm going to leave. And at a certain point, it did get that bad. I don't know what triggered it off. And I said, enough. I don't want this anymore. Quit in the middle of the evening, called my band manager and said, tell the band I want to see him after the job. They came up and I said, fellas, I'm leaving. And they looked at me stunned. I wasn't where I wanted to be. I was where I once thought I wanted to be, and it was not at all what I thought it was going to be. Dancing Coed starred a little girl named Lana Turner. It was her, I think, first starring vehicle. Played a few scenes with her. Phil Silvers, who was a good friend of mine at that time, he said, come on over to Metro. He was at Metro at the time, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And he took me on a set, And there we sat, and all of a sudden this vision of loveliness, this absolutely gorgeous, beautiful blonde girl in a dress that was so tight she had to be born in it, came down toward me. And Phil said, "Artie, this is Lana Turner." So we'd never met. We hadn't got along too well in the movie we made together because I would kid her, and she didn't understand I was kidding her. She'd get angry. I said, "If you don't dance right, I won't play your tempos." And she'd say, "Yeah, you better." It's got to be dumb. So now here she was, and she was a totally different person, radiant, smiling at me. And I was alone. I lived out here alone, and I had no friends. Lana and I talked a little bit, and I don't know, somehow we went out to dinner one night. And we got married that night. That night we got married. We found ourselves husband and wife without even knowing who we were. Being celebrated is a very lonesome state of affairs. And when you meet someone else who is on the verge of that, who hates it, you think, ah, I found a kindred soul. That was part of what happened with Lana and me. So here we were, both attracted to each other, and, you know, two glamorous figures meeting, and then all of a sudden each takes off the mask. And you say, "My God, who are you?" So it was hopeless. I mean, after all, you've got to live a normal life. Somebody's got to make coffee in the morning, whether it's you or they. And that lasted, predictably, for about 6 or 7 months. So much for Lana.
Of a lingering kiss, a warm embrace, but love is a whimsy as flimsy as lace, and my arms embrace an empty space, melancholy mood. Why must you blindly pity me and break the chains that bind me? Won't you release me, set me free, bring him back to me, oh melancholy mood.
The press seemed to have a lot of fun with the idea that I got married and divorced quite frequently. And when people talk about marriage and divorce, I tell them I know nothing about marriage, but I'm an expert on divorce. And the way you get a good divorce is to have a perfectly miserable marriage.
Nonetheless, among his many ex-wives, actress Ava Gardner spoke well of him and later said that Artie Shaw was
impossible to live with, but a worthwhile human being, an extraordinary man.
And as Artie Shaw himself said in a much later TV interview,
"You have no idea of the people I didn't marry."
Thank you.
outstanding performance of Carioca, and a performance by Artie Shaw and his band of that tune appeared in Flying Down to Rio, a Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers film, as part of a large production dance number. Before that, a snatch of Melancholy Moods sung by Helen Forrest at a recording session in Hollywood. You're listening to Jazz Rhythm. I'm Dave Radlauer. Thanks for joining me for this in-depth portrait of a remarkable musician, an icon of the swing era, and a man deeply, I guess you'd say, disheartened by his experience of being a celebrity in America. Still ahead on Artie Shaw Redux, he's swept up in World War II, the time he became a dairy farmer, the writer Artie Shaw, and fleeing the Red Scare. Back Bay Shuffle, which Artie Shaw wrote, named after the famous Back Bay of Boston, was one of 8 million selling tunes, of which Artie Shaw wrote 5. Here it is in a live 1938 radio broadcast.